from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And I'm going to talk about some things that kind of allude to what I've talked about before. But let's just say there's been a lot that's happened since the last time we've got into these subjects. First off, I'm going to mention that there's a new Pentagon operation called Operation Southern Spear. That kind of is encompassing everything that's happening in the Caribbean. And to a certain extent, I think it also incorporates what's happening in the East Pacific in terms of going after drug cartel boats. But there's a lot more down there sitting off the coast of Venezuela and the Caribbean that really needs to be looked at closely, because this is well beyond the capability you need to take out drug-laden fast boats or semi-submersibles. So I'm going to talk about that. And then I'm going to kind of lay out some things. I think there's a possibility of a really big deal, if you will, in the Middle East. And I know there was a big thing down in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt with the Middle East Peace Conference and great hopes for this deal with Gaza. That seems to have somewhat stalled out to a large extent. And I think what's going on behind the scenes are some very interesting things that connect some dots, if you will, to try and show what could happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen. And with anything dealt with the Middle East, the opportunity for everything to fall apart is always ever present. So I'm going to get into that. But let's talk first about this thing that's happening in the Western Hemisphere. Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, whatever you want to say. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth has formally announced the launch of a U.S. military operation to target what we call narco-terrorist cartels or narco-terrorists. And this is a pretty big buildup of total forces, although the ground forces side is rather limited, despite being very capable. They're Marines sitting on ship with a lot of things that they can do. But it's not an invasion force. This is not Desert Storm. This is not Operation Iraqi Freedom. This is not a force that's going to go in there and overthrow a country. It's just not that big. Although, if you listen to some of the media reports, and you certainly listen to the rhetoric coming out of Venezuela, they're trying to build it up to sound like there's an invasion force sitting offshore, but it's just simply not that big. Now, the naming of Operation Southern Spear coincides with the USS Gerald R. Ford, our most advanced aircraft carrier, that task force rolling into the Caribbean. It is now in the Caribbean. It's not right off the shores of Venezuela, but it's in the region, and it can move there very quickly to get to strike positions, if you will. And it's a really rather extraordinary show of U.S. military force. Certainly in the Western Hemisphere, in the area of responsibility that's U.S. Southern Command, we just simply haven't seen something like that forever. It's been a very long time. A lot have said that we haven't seen a maritime or a naval presence like that since probably the Cuban Missile Crisis. That gives you an idea of how far back that goes within the hemisphere. So in that regard, it's pretty big what we're seeing there, and we need to take that into consideration. Now, the Gerald R. Ford is a significant add to a significant presence that's already there. We have a Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is about 2,000 Marines. It's got a battalion, which is about 800 or so Marines in the ground forces. It's also got a composite air squadron with tilt rotor capability and with some other things. I don't recall if they have it. I think they do have, but I'm not sure if they have F-35s with the MEU as well. But they have a lot of capability to do a lot of things. And so that's there. And of course, the logistics and the command and control element that goes with that. So that's there. And then there's the ships that go with it, the amphibious ready group. And then the other part is that we have that carrier task force. And there's a lot of other associated ships out there that could launch missiles and do a number of other things that would make a big difference. So it is a very large task force that's down there. So far, what the U.S. has been doing is targeting drug boats, essentially. Fast boats, which are small boats, usually put a lot of bales of cocaine in them, And they have about three or four outboard engines, high-powered outboard engines, and they zip across the ocean as fast as they can. And for years, the problem has always been that they go faster than the Coast Guard ships or other ships that would go out to intercept them. So they would literally go so fast they couldn't be stopped. And that's a big problem. And unless you have something on the far end to stop them, to greet them when they hit the shore, you often just lose the opportunity to stop the load. It was very frustrating. We could see them. We knew what they were. We could clearly identify what they were about, but we had no way to stop them. That changed in early September when we started basically blowing them up, hitting them with Hellfire missiles or whatever ordnance we were going to hit them with and destroying them. The other thing that they have are these semi-submersibles. Remind me a little bit of what used to call submarines at Disneyland, in that they don't completely go underwater. The conning tower and some of the top of the craft are always above water, and it basically moves not at a fast pace, but at a pretty deliberate pace across the ocean. But because of that, it is very low profile. So it's difficult to see visually. It's very difficult to pick up on radar. It's going so low that it gets caught up in the ocean scatter, if you will, with waves and everything else. It's very difficult to see this thing moving out in the ocean. But that's another thing. Those things can carry a lot of cocaine. They can carry, it's not uncommon that there will be a few tons of cocaine that are in those things when they stop them. But the danger there is when they stop them, that the crew would often come out and the last person out would pull something or whatever, and they would scuttle the thing, and it would sink to the bottom of the ocean. So you'd have the crew, but you wouldn't have the cocaine itself, which is the evidence. And some years back, they actually changed the law to make it a felony, basically to crew a semi-submersible. And that, I kind of want to point to that, is the assumption is that the only reason you would be in a semi-submersible on the ocean is if you were smuggling contraband, illegal drugs. So there was kind of a built-in assumption within that law. And it is the only purpose that we've ever seen that these things are actually out there. So we've been hitting those as well. We've been hitting them in the Caribbean, coming out of Venezuela, and we've been hitting them in the East Pacific. It appears so far the targeting methodology is that when the boat leaves territorial waters and it's in international waters, and by definition, because of what the boat is, it is a stateless vessel. In other words, no country claims that as their ship, as their vessel afloat. It's a stateless vessel in international waters, and we see where it's tied to. It's obviously a drug trafficking vessel. We have designated the drug trafficking groups as narco-terrorists or terrorist groups, and we're doing the same thing with identified terrorists in the water that we've been doing on the ground in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and elsewhere around the world for many years. There is a lot of pushback on that. There's a lot of pushback on the international scene on that. A lot of people refer to it as extrajudicial killings, but that is the rationale behind why we're targeting those things. Now, President Maduro of Venezuela was not legitimately reelected to office. He got maybe less than a third of the vote compared to the opposition, but he completely rigged it to stay in power, and he went after the opposition with his security forces. And you may have seen that the head of the opposition recently won the Nobel Peace Prize because of her valiant stand against the Maduro regime, which is a left-wing pseudo-communist dictatorship in Venezuela. And they have. And I should also mention that Maduro and his predecessor Chavez managed to take a pretty thriving economy with a very vibrant oil industry and just run it right into the dirt. And oil exports, oil production out there is about a fourth or a fifth of what it was prior to that, those two back leaders, for lack of a better term, of Venezuela and all the damage that they've done in that country. Now, Maduro is accusing the U.S. of creating false narratives to justify attacks on its vessels and to threaten the country. We don't see Maduro as a legitimate national leader. We see him as an illegitimate leader. We see him, and we have said that he is tied in with the drug cartels. And that's something that a lot of people have missed, is that over the last two decades, the government of Venezuela and the drug cartels that use Venezuela to transit narcotics to the U.S. and elsewhere around the world, they have become completely interwoven. The military and security forces have been pulled into the drug business. They facilitate, aid, enable the drug traffickers to move drugs from central, from north, or I should say from the Andean coca production region to Venezuela. And then Venezuela basically just gives them a free hand to send those things out on fast boats or semi-submersibles, whatever, all over. Some, most of them go up to North America. Usually what they'll do with the fast boats is they'll zip up to a little island and then they'll transship it to something else and then eventually makes it way up to the U.S., various different routes. The other thing we've seen too is they've been using those semi-submersibles to go all the way across the Atlantic, where they offload as far north as Europe off the Iberian coast. So we've seen a lot of this stuff. And with Venezuela basically saying, hey, we're open for business to drug traffickers, it has really enabled them to do a lot. And they have been doing stuff. Now, what the U.S. does not have is an invasion force to take over Venezuela. What we do have is an incredibly capable strike package force that could go in there and do a lot. That Gerald R. Ford, among other things, it has a different catapult system than the catapult systems that carriers have been using. It took a lot of work. It had some bugs they had to work out, but it's an electromagnetic aircraft launch system called EMALS, all right? And it's faster, smoother, more efficient, about 30% more efficient than the previous catapult system, which means it's more efficient to launch and recover aircraft in a quicker period of time, which means that you can do more strike missions, or what we call sorties, more flights of aircraft going in there to do strike missions than you could before. So it's a very capable platform for that. All right. It also has advanced arresting gear, which enhances the ability to absorb and safely recover aircraft. So you got on both ends, the launch feature and the recovery feature. And it's got advanced weapons elevators, which use electromagnetic motors, which means that they can move the ammunition to arm the aircraft that much faster, quicker, and safer. And it's got about 70-plus aircraft on board. Now, right now, I haven't seen where this has F-35s on board. What I'm seeing right now is they have F-18s, F-18 Super Hornets, the latest group that's out there, very capable aircraft. And they've also got EA-18G Growlers. And it's another way of saying that they can do electronic warfare while also doing strike missions, which could really have a huge effect on a place like Venezuela that is not set up to deal with this stuff like this. There's also an F-35 squadron that's sitting up at Roosevelt Roads in Puerto Rico, and they've reopened the Navy airfield there, so it's also able to use other things like tankers and other types of aircraft that would enable this mission as well. So there's a lot going on, all right? So what's Venezuela going to do? Venezuela's kind of taken a page from the Viet Cong playbook, if you will. I'd say more closer to the to today would be what we saw in Iraq, where the military, they have this kind of the citizen militia, this militia force, if you will, of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans. They're not well-trained. They're not particularly capable, but there's a lot of them, and they arm them. And the idea is that if the U.S. invades, that they would meld into the countryside with the military melding in the countryside, and they would work together as these guerrilla insurgent elements that would grind down the U.S. military presence. And that is a proven technique, and that's a proven tactic or strategy that a lot of countries have used over the years. The issue is, I don't think we're going to do that. I think what we're going to do is we're going to use our advantages, which is our ability to do these deep strike missions. We can do a variety of raids. When I say raid, when you go in and raid someplace, your intent is not to take it permanently. The intent is to go in and usually destroy it. And so we use raids to basically debilitate a lot of these places, put uncertainty, fear within the security forces, the military, and the general population of what the U.S. is able to do. Do strike missions at some point. I imagine we're going to have air superiority rather quickly. And we may end up with air supremacy, what you saw with the Israelis in Iran, where they could literally just fly in and bomb stuff at will. And in doing that, eliminate the drug cartel facilities. And I think that'll be the primary thing because the justification of what this is, going after terrorists, go after those things. But because of the way the government's interwoven with the drug cartel business, it is very likely that we're going to hit some government facilities, some military facilities and stuff, because frankly, they're working with the drug cartels. So that's what I would see if we're going to do something like this. And that's what I see Venezuela doing. Now, could Venezuela launch some sort of covert terrorist attacks? They're not going to invade the U.S., but could they launch some sort of covert terrorist attacks in the U.S.? They could certainly try. And I think that we're on our toes to look at that. And I think that's something that we need to be very concerned about, is that they will do some sort of hybrid warfare thing, aiming if not the U.S. territory, U.S. interests in the region, maybe going after embassies or U.S. corporate industrial targets in Central South America, something like that, or maybe even try to attack one of our ships at sea. Anyway, there's a lot of different things I'm sure they're looking at, but I think the hope is, and maybe the planning is, that if they engage in this massive series of strike missions all over Venezuela, that the government will simply collapse. I think it might be a little optimistic to think that a democratically elected government by the opposition is going to suddenly take its place. But then again, President Trump has indicated that we're doing something on the covert action side. And so there might be more going on back there to put a new government in place very quickly than we realize. All right. Now, are the drug cartels terrorist groups? Let me give you the FBI definition of terrorism. The FBI defines terrorism as the unlawful use of force or violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government or civilian population in the furtherance of political or social objectives. Now, if you look at the drug cartels in Venezuela, they have basically become part of the government, if you will. They terrorize the population. They intimidate. They've taken basically political control, if you will. They actually have political power within Venezuela. And that saw the same thing over in Colombia in years past. You see the same problem with the cartels in Mexico and elsewhere, where they power, their wealth and everything gives them ability to control the political spectrum of what goes on in those nations and that society. So by that definition, you're getting pretty close to the FBI definition for terrorism, which is close to the, which is in sync with the international definition of terrorism as well. So there is an argument, certainly a strong argument, I think, to be made that these cartels are not just criminal organizations out there making money, that they are doing far more than that. All right. So that's Venezuela. That's Operation Southern Spear. That's what's going on there right now. And that's what could happen. Now, let me shift gears here. Something rather interesting is occurring. Steve Witkoff, the president's envoy, if you will, to the pretty much everything I can think of, is meeting with one of the architects of October 7th. He's Hamas leader Khalil al-Haya, and they're going to talk about the ceasefire, and that should be coming up here very quickly. He's Hamas, a designated terrorist organization. He's definitely a terrorist, and the timing of the meeting is a little uncertain right now, but Hamas and the White House and others have not really commented that heavily on it, at least so far. I think you'll see more. But the problem they're running into is we have this big agreement with Hamas. Phase one, the Israeli Defense Forces pulled back to this yellow line, and Hamas popped out of the ground and immediately started basically killing everybody who would possibly oppose them on the streets. Summary executions, literally lining up people they didn't like and just shooting them in the back of the head, and basically reasserting themselves as a governing entity and as a terror element within the Gaza Strip. That's very painful. That is not the intent of the agreement that something like this happened. And with that, the aid has been going in, and Hamas folks and folks aligned with Hamas have been jumping on the back of the trucks and stealing the aid and taking it for themselves, which again undermines what the intent of the of this was supposed to be. And there's not a lot of movement towards disarming Hamas or putting in a new governance or governing body separate from Hamas. And so things are stalled out, in other words. And so this is a bold move. Now, there's some other things going on as well. The U.S. is committed to selling 48 F-35s, air superiority aircraft. It's our highest end aircraft out there right now for fighter bombers. And we're going to sell them to Saudi Arabia. We have offered years back under the Biden administration to sell F-35s to the United Arab Emirates. That deal eventually fell through. But at that time, there was pressure by Israel on the U.S., and we said, hey, UAE, could you join the Abraham Accords? Could you normalize relations with Israel? And that would make it easier for us to sell you these F-35s. Now, that deal, UAE actually did end up normalizing relations. They joined the Abraham Accords. That deal for the F-35s didn't happen. But now Israel's asking the U.S., hey, can you condition this sale to Saudi Arabia. The problem that the Crown Prince and the government of Saudi Arabia has with normalizing relations with Israel, which was something that was probably going to happen before the October 7th attacks. That's one of the big reasons that Hamas was motivated to do the October 7th attacks, was to derail that, which they have done for over 2 years, is that for political reasons, certainly within Saudi Arabia and within the region, the Saudis need something that points to an eventual Palestinian state, that the Palestinian people will eventually have their own nation state at some point in the future. Israel's internal politics are such that they're having a very difficult time coalescing around that. And certainly Netanyahu's coalition, his far-right coalition, there's members of that coalition that want to send the Palestinians literally out into the desert, if you will, in some sort of exodus thing or whatever, and just send them out there and send them out to different countries of the world or whatever, and come in and simply occupy and take over the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and everything else. So you got some pretty extreme views represented in Netanyahu's coalition there that he's trying to deal with. So what they said is, hey, we would like to condition the F-35 sales to normalizing relations. Obviously, you see Saudi Arabia has a political problem with that. Okay, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, is meeting with President Trump this week. They're inevitably going to talk about the five deal. That's going to be a big part of what's going on there. They're also inevitably going to be talking about the request by the Israelis to normalize relations. Now, while all this is going on, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and other Arab countries have a draft resolution before the UN that they've all signed up on. It's been circulated around, been looked at and stuff. And basically, it's a resolution that leads to a point where at some point in the future, there's at least the aspirational goal of a Palestinian state. The U.S. has signed off on this. We have agreed to it. That is big. We have opposed a number of resolutions that have been talking about Palestinian statehood and all this stuff, but we appear to be okay with this one. Now, this is a big deal, and if Israel could acquiesce to such a thing, and it takes out, obviously, very strict requirements of when this thing would take place and other things, if it was put in certain terms, what I do see is this. I see a way of, if Israel can acquiesce to the resolution, Saudi Arabia could have what it needs to normalize relations with Israel and join the Abraham Accords. And I'll get to what that does regionally. And that puts tremendous wind in the sails of Witkoff talking to Hamas, saying, you've got nobody out there that's going to support you guys. You're done. You saw what we all did to Iran. The Saudis are normalizing relations, which is exactly what you were trying to stop from happening with October 7th. You're going to have to disarm and go along with this thing. I think that what I see is the possibility of a grand bargain, if you will, of a big deal where the interests of all the different parties could potentially be met. With that said, do I see that thing falling apart? You bet. Now, this is going up to the UN Security Council, and they're hoping for swift adoption of this thing, but it's got eight countries with the United States that are doing this. It is something that I think would be, if it works, if the Israelis could either nod to it or at least not vote against it or whatever, if they were to do this, I think it could lead to something. I also think that 48-5s going to Saudi Arabia could really change the strategic math in the Middle East. What Israel's concerned about is they have a qualitative military advantage over all the other countries out there. With those F-35s going to Saudi Arabia and stuff, Israel's qualitative advantage shifts because these countries have weapons that are commensurate with what Israel has. It's best stuff. However, if relations are normalized, what this does is it would put Israel with the Gulf states to contain the radical Shiite mullahs in Iran, and that it would be a huge shift in relations. All right. Anyway, that could be the grand deal. Those are two things I want to talk about today. It's a bold move. Will it work? I don't know. But I just wanted to explain the different components and try to connect the dots to see how this might all fit together. Could members of Netanyahu's coalition shoot this down? and put so much pressure on Netanyahu that they absolutely come out of opposition to the resolution? You bet. That could easily happen as well, and there's certainly precedents to point to on that. But if they could put this together, I think all the parties involved could get enough of what they need to get that next step, and I think that's what could eventually bring a genuine push towards a peace deal, a substantive peace deal within the Gaza Strip, and maybe a peace deal that incorporates all the Middle East, with the exception of Iran. That's a separate issue. All right. Thanks for listening to Strat. Please go to stratpodcast.com. You can also go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kimford TV. There's a Strat Podcast YouTube channel as well. You can always go to my corporate website at www.gripsa, Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, and then I have SA on it, which is short for Situational Awareness, but gripsa.com. And thanks again, and I hope you listen to the next one.